Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are diving deep into the fascinating domain of natural language processing, or NLP.
That's right.
In essence, NLP is about equipping machines with the ability to, well, understand human language. And for you, our listener, who's maybe, you know, prepping for your NLP final exam, this deep dive is laser focused on the key concepts and terms from your course description, basically everything you need to feel confident.
Exactly. Your course sounds like it gives a really broad understanding of how machines can process and understand language. And that paves the way for some incredible applications: machine translation, automatic summarization, question answering systems, even those, you know, conversational abilities of dialogue systems.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Our goal today is really to distill the core principles from your studies, making sure you grasp not just the what, but also the why behind these technologies.
Okay, let's unpack this then. We'll start with the very first steps, text normalization and tokenization.
The groundwork.
Yeah, how we clean up and break down raw text so machines can even begin to process it. Mm. We'll tackle the challenges involved, maybe even some language-specific oddities.
That's nice.
Then we'll explore regular expressions, those powerful tools for finding and manipulating patterns in text.
Following that, we'll look at edit distance. It's a surprisingly versatile measure of how similar two pieces of text are.
Right.
Then we'll move into the world of probabilities with n-gram language models. You'll understand how these models learn from text, the crucial step of smoothing to handle unseen words, and how we measure their effectiveness.
Okay.
We'll then dive into vector space semantics, exploring how we can represent the meaning of words as vectors, both sparse and dense representations, including the magic of word embeddings.
Here's where it gets really interesting, I think. We'll navigate the realm of sequence models, which are kind of the backbone of tasks, like part of speech tagging, figuring out the grammatical role of each word. We'll touch on Hitta-Markov models, MEMS, CRFs, and recurrent neural networks, plus constituency parsing, which is about understanding sentence structure.
Hierarchy, yeah. We'll also cover dependency parsing, looking at how words relate to each other grammatically.
Okay.
Semantic role labeling will follow, where we aim to understand basically who is doing what to whom in a sentence. And of course, we have to talk about the modern giants, masked language models like BERT, and the crucial technique of fine-tuning them for specific tasks.
Right, BERT.
Along with large language models and the art of prompting them. Finally, we'll touch on how these principles apply in information retrieval, question answering, and those dialogue systems your course mentioned.
So think of this as your express lane to reviewing the essentials. We're not just reciting definitions. We want to give you the underlying insights. You
know, exactly. Right? Connect the dots.
Connect these concepts to those real-world applications you're learning about. Hopefully, by the end, you'll have that solid foundation you need for the exam. Let's kick things off with regular expressions. What exactly are they, and why are they like the unsung heroes of text processing?
Right. Regular expressions, or REs.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of them as superpowered search patterns for text. Imagine being able to describe the exact kind of text you're looking for. Maybe it's an email address format or a phone number, or I don't know, all words starting with a capital letter.
Okay.
REs provide a formal language to do just that, that specify these patterns concisely and flexibly. They are absolutely fundamental for searching, extracting specific info, and even transforming text based on rules you define.
Okay, so instead of just searching for the literal word cat, I could maybe look for any three-letter word starting with cat, like cat, cab, can.
Precisely. That's the power. It comes from a few core building blocks. First, simple concatenation, just putting characters together to match a sequence. Then you have disjunction, the OR operator, basically saying match this OR, match that.
Mm.
And character sets let you define a group of characters to match at a point, like AZ for any lowercase letter. You can do ranges or even negation match anything excepting these characters. It's like mini language for text patterns.
That sounds incredibly useful, especially for sifting through huge amounts of text. You mentioned their role in text normalization and tokenization.
Absolutely crucial. Before we can really analyze text, we often need to clean it up and break it into meaningful units, right?
Yeah.
And RAs are often our first line of defense. You might use them to strip out weird characters or to define what constitutes a word boundary when we get to tokenization. And as your notes probably mentioned, they're a workhorse in command line tools like grep for finding patterns in files. That just shows their practical power.
Which leads us nicely to text normalization and tokenization itself. Normalization sounds like, well, making text more machine friendly. Is that the gist?
That's exactly the gist. Text normalization is this really crucial process of transforming raw, messy text into a more consistent, analyzable format. Think of it as prepping the text before our NLP algorithms get their hands on it. And the very first step in that prep is usually tokenization.
Tokenization. Okay, breaking text into individual tokens. Mm. But what exactly is a token? It can't just be splitting by spaces, can it? That seems too simple.
You've hit on a key challenge right away. Yeah, splitting by white space is a starting point, but it breaks down super quickly. Think about New York. Is that one token, the city, or two separate tokens, New and York?
Right, right. Or contractions like I'm, is that one word, or should it be I and am?
Exactly. And I bet your notes mentioned dealing with things like emoticons.
Yeah.
Or hashtags, hashtag NLP, website URLs, email addresses.
Yeah, and punctuation stuck to words.
Precisely. Then you have things like clitic contractions, whatever, multi-word expressions like rock and roll. And the complexity just explodes when you look at languages like Japanese or Chinese that don't use spaces between words.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
In Chinese, a single character, a hanzi, can often be a whole morpheme carrying meaning by itself.
So how do you even start segmenting text in those languages? The notes mention something called maximum matching.
Yeah, maximum matching, sometimes called the greedy approach, is a basic technique. Imagine you have a big dictionary of all known Chinese words. This method scans the input text and tries to find the longest sequence of characters from the start that matches a word in the dictionary.
Okay.
It's greedy because it just takes the longest match it finds right away, which isn't always the best overall segmentation, but it's a place to start.
And byte pair encoding, BPE, that sounds maybe more sophisticated.
BPE is definitely more sophisticated, and it's become super popular, especially with large language models. It's a type of subword tokenization. It starts by treating every single character as its own token. Then it looks for the pair of adjacent tokens that occurs most frequently in the training data and merges them into a single new token.
Ah.
It keeps doing this merging process over and over based on frequency, either for a set number of merges or until the vocabulary reaches a desired size. What you end up with is a set of merge rules and a vocabulary that might contain whole words, common parts of words, or even individual characters.
And the benefit is?
The big benefit is handling unknown words. If the model sees a word it hasn't encountered, it can also break it down into known subword units from its BPE vocabulary. It also helps manage vocabulary size.
Okay, that makes sense. So tokenization gets us to the basic units. What's next in normalization? The notes mentioned normalizing word formats.
Right. Once we have our tokens, we often need to standardize their form, make them consistent. A common step is case folding, converting everything to lowercase usually. Or sometimes uppercase.
Why would you do that?
Well, in something like information retrieval, you probably want to search for apple to also find apple, the fruit, right? So collapsing case helps treat them the same.
But couldn't that cause problems sometimes? Like apple the company versus apple the fruit?
Exactly. That's the trade-off. Case folding can sometimes lose important distinctions. So whether you do it depends on the specific task.
Okay. Then there's lemmatization and stemming. They both seem to be about getting words down to their root form. What's the difference?
They're related, yeah, but they work differently. Lemmatization aims to find the actual dictionary form of a word. It's a lemma. So the lemma of running, ran, and runs is run. This usually needs some understanding of the language's morphology, how words are built from stems and affixes. It often involves using a dictionary.
Okay.
Stemming, on the other hand, is typically a cruder, more rule-based approach. It just tries to chop off common prefixes or suffixes based on a list of rules. The Porter stemmer is a classic example for English.
So it might not always result in a real word.
Exactly. Stemming can sometimes overgeneralize and create stems that aren't actual words, like computation might become compute. Or it might undergeneralize and fail to group words that should be together.
So lemmatization sounds more accurate, but maybe slower or needs more resources.
That's a good way to put it. Generally, yes. Lemmatization requires more linguistic knowledge, often a lexicon and morphological analyzer. Stemming is usually faster, but less precise. And normalization can go beyond this, standardizing things like abbreviations, USA to US perhaps.
Yeah.
Fixing typos maybe. Handling dates and numbers.
Right. And finally, sentence segmentation, figuring out where sentences start and end. That sounds easy. Just look for periods.
You'd think so. But it's tricky. Periods can end a sentence, but they can also appear in abbreviations like Mr. or USA or in numbers. So sentence boundary detection needs slightly smarter rules or models.
Okay, makes sense. Now, the notes also threw out some fundamental terms here. Token, type, vocabulary V, corpus, and Herden's law or Heap's law. Let's just nail those down quickly for the exam prep.
Good idea. So a token is an individual instance of a word or symbol in the text after tokenization. Like in The Cat Sat on the Mat, there are 6 tokens.
Okay.
A type is a unique word form in the text. In that same sentence, the types are the cat sat on mat. So 5 types. The vocabulary, usually written as V, is just the set of all the unique types in your text collection. So V would be 5 in our example. A corpus, plural, dot corpora, is simply the collection of text you're working with. Could be a book, a set of articles, tweets, whatever.
And Herden's or Heap's law.
Right. That describes an interesting empirical pattern. As your corpus gets bigger, more tokens, N, the number of unique words, the vocabulary size V, also grows, but it grows slower and slower. The relationship is often modeled as V equal K no me, where K and phi are constants that depend on the text. It basically says you keep finding new words, but less frequently as you see more text.
Fascinating. Okay, so we've cleaned and broken down our text. Now, how do we measure how similar 2 pieces of text are, especially if they're not identical? That's where edit distance comes in, right?
Exactly. Edit distance gives us a way to quantify the similarity, or maybe dissimilarity, between 2 strings. It counts the minimum number of single character edits needed to change one string into the other.
And what kind of edits are we talking about?
The standard ones are insertion, adding a character, deletion, removing one, and substitution, changing one character to another. The fewer edits you need, the more similar the strings are considered to be.
And this isn't just some abstract idea, right? It has real uses.
Oh, absolutely. Think about spell checkers. When you type something wrong, the suggestions it gives are often words that have a small edit distance to your typo.
Okay. That makes sense.
It's also used in speech recognition to compare the transcribed text to the actual spoken words, in bioinformatics to compare DNA sequences, even in things like corpus resolution or plagiarism detection. It's surprisingly fundamental.
The notes mention the minimum edit distance algorithm uses dynamic programming. Can you give us a feel for how that works without getting too deep in the weeds?
Sure. Imagine you have 2 words, say intention and execution. The algorithm builds a grid, or a matrix. Let's call it D. Cell number EJ in this grid will store the minimum edit distance between the first E characters of word 1, intention, and the first E characters of word 2, execution. It starts by filling the edges, the distance from an empty string, to prefixes of the words. Then it fills the rest of the grid, usually row by row or column by column. To calculate the value for D, J, it looks at the values of its neighbors, day 1, J, representing a deletion, D, J1, representing an insertion, and D1, J1, representing a substitution or potentially no change if the characters match.
And it picks the cheapest option.
Exactly. It calculates the cost of reaching D, J via each of those 3 paths, adding the cost of the required operation, deletion, insertion, or substitution, and takes the minimum. The final answer, the minimum edit distance between the whole words, is in the bottom right cell of the grid.
And you can figure out the actual edits, too.
Yes, by keeping track of which choice, deletion, insertion, substitution, led to the minimum value at each cell, using back pointers. You can trace a path back from the end to the start to get the alignment and the sequence of edits. A very common version is the Levenshtein distance, where insertion, deletion, and substitution all just cost 1.
So it's a really systematic way to find the absolute minimum number of changes.
Precisely. Dynamic programming makes sure you find the optimal solution efficiently without having to try every single possible combination of edits.
Okay, so we can process text and measure similarity. Now, how do we start actually modeling the language itself using probabilities? This brings us to probabilistic models and n-gram language models. The notes start with Bayes' rule. Feels like that pops up everywhere.
It really does. Bayes' rule is absolutely fundamental for probabilistic reasoning in NLP and, well, many other fields. It gives us a mathematical way to update our belief in a hypothesis given some new evidence. So the probability of a hypothesis, C, like, say, a sentence being grammatically correct, given some observed data, D, the sentence itself, relates to how likely we were to see that data if the hypothesis was true, times our prior belief in the hypothesis, divided by the overall probability of seeing the data.
P of C given D equals P of D given C times P of C over P of D, something like that.
Exactly that. It lets us flip the conditional probability around, which is often very useful.
Okay, so we have this rule. How do we actually build a model that uses probabilities to understand language? The notes mentioned estimating model parameters.
When we build a probabilistic model, we're basically trying to capture the underlying probabilities that generated the data we see. These probabilities are the model's parameters. We use data, a sample, and an estimator, a method, to figure out the best values for these parameters.
Mm-hmm.
The data likelihood is a key concept here. It's the probability of observing the actual data we have given a specific set of parameter values. We usually want to find the parameters that make our observed data seem as likely as possible.
And how do we find those best parameters? Maximum likelihood estimation, MLE, was mentioned.
Maximum likelihood estimation, MLE, is a very common approach. The idea is really intuitive. Choose the parameter values that maximize the likelihood of the observed data. So if we're building a model of word probabilities and we see the word the 100 times in a 1,000-word corpus, the MLE estimate for the probability of the is simply 100 divided by 1,000, or 0.1. You just use the relative frequencies.
Seems straightforward, but what's the catch? You mentioned it runs into problems.
The big catch is sparsity, especially with limited data. Imagine you're estimating the probability of a specific sequence of, say, three words, a trigram. If you've never seen that exact trigram in your training data, MLE will assign it a probability of 0.
And that's bad because?
Because it means the model thinks that sequence is impossible. But just because we haven't seen it doesn't mean it can't happen. Assigning zero probability can cause huge problems, especially when combining probabilities later on.
Which leads us straight to smoothing, right? Like Laplace smoothing. How does that fix the zero problem?
Exactly. Smoothing techniques are designed to address this zero probability issue. Laplace smoothing, also called add one smoothing, is the simplest. It works by pretending we've seen every possible event at least once more than we actually did. You add one to the count of every single event, like every possible word or every possible bgram.
So even things we didn't see get a count of one.
Yes, and then you adjust the denominator accordingly, usually by adding the total vocabulary size to make sure the probability still sum to one. The formula looks something like PYC, count YC plus one, total count in C plus V. It guarantees that nothing gets a zero probability.
Okay, so it just gives a little bit of probability mass to everything.
Precisely. It redistributes the probability slightly. It's related to the idea of having some prior belief or using regularization. There are more advanced smoothing methods, but Laplace gives you the basic idea.
Okay, so we can estimate probabilities and smooth them. Now, how do we build a full probabilistic language model, LM? Your course description mentioned machine translation and dialogue systems predicting sequences must be key there.
Absolutely key. A probabilistic language model aims to assign a probability to any sequence of words, PW, PW1, W2, WN. It tells us how likely a given sentence or phrase is in a particular language. This is fundamental for tons of applications. Predicting the next word in your phone's keyboard, ranking translation options, scoring hypotheses, and speech recognition.
And how do you calculate the probability of a whole sequence?
You can use the chain rule of probability. The probability of the whole sequence is the probability of the first word times the probability of the second word given the first times probability of the third word given the first two, and so on.
PW1, W2, WN, PW1, W1, PW2, W1, PW3, W1, W.
Exactly. But calculating those long conditional probabilities like PWN, W1.WN-1 is computationally very hard and suffers badly from data sparsity. You'd need immense amounts of data.
And this is where that Markov assumption helps us out by simplifying the history we look at.
Precisely. The Markov assumption is the core simplification behind n-gagram models. It assumes that the probability of a word depends only on a limited number of preceding words, not the entire history. So an n-gram model looks at sequences of n-words.
Like unigrams, biggrams, trigrams.
Right. A unigram model, N1, assumes each word is independent, P-A-Y. A mutogram model, N2, assumes a word only depends on the immediately preceding word, P-Y-Y-Y-1. A trigram, N-N-O, depends on the previous two, P-Y-Y-2, Y-1, and so on for k-grams.
So in a biggram model, the probability of seeing, say, world after hello is just estimated based on how often hello world occurs compared to just hello?
That's exactly the maximum likelihood estimate for biggram probabilities. PYY1 is approximated by count Y1 divided by count Y1.
Okay.
But of course, we still have practical issues. Multiplying lots of small probabilities leads to numerical underflow. So we usually work in log space, adding log probabilities instead of multiplying probabilities.
Yeah, okay.
And we still have the zero count problem for unseen bigrams, so smoothing is absolutely essential for n-gram models.
Right. Back to Laplace or something more advanced.
Yes. And we also often need a way to handle words that weren't in our training vocabulary at all. We typically map these out-of-vocabulary or OOV words to a special UNC token.
And there are tools to build these.
Yep. Powerful toolkits like SRILM and KenLM exist that handle the counting, smoothing, and storing these models efficiently.
So how do we know if one Enneagram model is better than another? Evaluation must be important. You mentioned Perplexity.
Evaluation is critical. We can do it extrinsically. See how much our LM improves a downstream task like machine translation. Or we could do it intrinsically, directly measuring the quality of the LM itself on some held-out test data. Perplexity is the standard intrinsic metric. Mathematically, it's related to the inverse probability the model assigns to the test set, normalized by the number of words.
Okay, what does that mean intuitively?
Intuitively, you can think of perplexity as the average branching factor of the language according to the model. It's like, on average, how many choices does the model think it has for the next word? A lower perplexity score means the model is less surprised by the test set, assigns higher probability to the words that actually occurred, and is therefore considered a better model.
So a perplexity of 10 is better than 50 because the model is more certain about what comes next.
Exactly. But we need to be careful about overfitting. A model might get very low perplexity on data similar to its training set, but generalize poorly to new data. Smoothing helps prevent this. And beyond add one, there are better smoothing techniques. Interpolation combines predictions from different Enneagram orders like trigram, biggram, unigram using learned weights, lambdas. Backoff uses lower order n-grams only when higher order counts are zero or very low.
And you tune these weights on separate data.
Yes, typically on a held out development set.
Yeah.
We also need to consider if it's an open vocabulary task where we expect unknown words or closed vocabulary, fixed vocabulary. For really huge web-scale n-gram models, efficiency becomes paramount. Techniques like pruning low-count n-grams or using approximations like stupid backoff are needed.
Wow, okay. That gives us a solid grasp on modeling language sequences probabilistically. Now let's shift gears a bit and think about the meaning of individual words. Vector space semantics. This sounds like trying to capture nuances that n-grams might miss.
Absolutely. N-grams capture statistical co-occurrence, but they don't directly represent semantic relationships like synonymy, similar meaning, or antonymy, opposite meaning, or broader associations. Vector space semantics aims to represent word meaning geometrically as vectors or points in a high-dimensional space.
Vectors, like arrows in space.
Sort of, yeah, points in space. The key idea is the distributional hypothesis. Words that appear in similar contexts tend to have similar meanings. You shall know a word by the company it keeps, as the saying goes.
So the meaning of cat is somehow related to the words that typically appear around cat, like purr, meow, pet, milk.
Exactly. By analyzing these contexts across a large corpus, we can build a vector for each word that captures its distributional profile, and hopefully its meaning. We generally talk about two main types of vector representations, sparse and dense.
Okay, what are sparse vectors?
Sparse vector representations are typically very high dimensional, where each dimension might correspond to a specific context item, maybe another word in the vocabulary, or even a document the word appeared in. A common example is the term document matrix, often used in information retrieval. Each row is a word, each column is a document, and the cell value indicates how often the word appears in that document. These vectors are sparse because most words don't appear in most documents, so most values are zero. Another type is a term-term matrix, or word context matrix, where rows are target words and columns represent context words, e.g. words within a certain window, and the cell value counts co-occurrences.
And these counts can be weighted. I saw TF-IDF mentioned again in the notes here.
Yes, raw counts aren't always the best. TF-IDF, term frequency inverse document frequency, is a very common weighting scheme for term document matrices. Term frequency, TF, is just how often a word appears in a specific document. Inverse document frequency, IDF, measures how rare or common a word is across the entire collection of documents. Rare words get a higher IDF score.
So TF-IDF gives higher weight to words that are frequent in this document, but rare overall, making them more indicative of the document's topic.
Precisely. It helps downweight common words like the or is, and upweight more specific informative terms. Other weighting schemes like PPMI, positive pointwise mutual information, are often used for term matrices to better measure the association between words.
Okay, those are sparse vectors. What about the dense ones? Word embeddings like Word2Vec, FastText, Glove, what makes them dense?
Dense vector models, usually called word embeddings, represent each word as a relatively low-dimensional vector, maybe 50 to 300 dimensions, compared to tens or hundreds of thousands for sparse vectors.
Okay, much smaller.
Much smaller, yes. And critically, these vectors are dense because most of the values in them are non-zero. They are learned, typically using neural networks, from large amounts of text.
And what are the advantages?
Several advantages. They're computationally more efficient due to the lower dimensionality. They tend to generalize better to unseen contexts. And importantly, they're designed to capture semantic similarities directly. Words with similar meanings, like cat and feline, tend to end up with embeddings that are close together in the vector space, even if they don't always share the exact same neighbors.
That sounds powerful. How are they actually learned? Word2Vec seems like a key example.
Word2Vec is a very influential family of models for learning embeddings. There are two main architectures. SkipGram tries to predict the surrounding context words given a target center word. It trains a simple neural network to do this prediction. Essentially, it learns embeddings such that words appearing in similar contexts has similar embeddings.
And the other one, CBOW.
CBOW, continuous bag of words, does the reverse. It tries to predict the target center word from its surrounding context words, treating the context as a bag of words, ignoring order. Both approaches result in powerful word embeddings learned as the weights of the neural network.
Okay, and FastText and Glove. Different approaches again.
Yes. FastText, developed by Facebook, builds on Word2Vec but adds a twist. It considers subword information. It represents each word as a collection of character n-grams, like three-letter sequences within the word.
Character n-grams, why?
This helps tremendously with rare words or out-of-vocabulary words, because even if the whole word is unknown, its character n-grams might have been seen in other words. It also helps capture morphological similarities for languages with lots of prefixes and suffixes. The final word embedding is often the sum of its character n-gram embeddings.
Interesting. And Glove?
Glove, Global Vectors, from Stanford, takes a different philosophical approach. Instead of predicting local contexts like Word2Vec, it tries to directly learn embeddings that capture the global co-occurrence statistics of words in the entire corpus. It optimizes the embeddings so that their dot product relates to the logarithm of their probability of co-occurring.
So, different ways to leverage distributional information. Are these static embeddings? Like, does Bank always have the same vector?
Yes. These models, Word2Vec, Glove, FastText, produce static embeddings. The word bank would have the same vector whether it means a river bank or a financial institution. This is a limitation. More recent models, like BERT, which we'll discuss later, produce dynamic or contextual embeddings where the vector for bank changes depending on the sentence it appears in. But these static embeddings were a huge step forward.
And how do we know if these embeddings are any good? How are they evaluated?
Good question. We use both intrinsic and extrinsic evaluations. Intrinsic evaluation tests the embeddings directly on specific semantic tasks, for example, word similarity tasks. How well does the cosine similarity between embeddings correlate with human judgments of word similarity, using datasets like WordSim353 or Simlex999, or word analogy tasks? Can the embeddings solve analogies like man is to king as woman is to queen, using vec man plus vec woman, vec queen? Extrinsic evaluation uses the embeddings as input features for some downstream NLP task, like sentiment analysis or named entity recognition. If using these embeddings improves the performance on that task compared to some baseline, it suggests the embeddings are capturing useful semantic information.
And these embeddings can actually reveal semantic properties, like finding synonyms or solving those analogies.
They really can. Calculating cosine similarity between vectors is the standard way to measure semantic similarity in this space. Finding the nearest neighbors of a word, the words with the highest cosine similarity, often reveals synonyms or strongly related words. And the analogy tasks show that the spatial arrangement of these vectors captures relational meanings. They can also reveal biases present in the training data, which is an important area of research ensuring fairness.
Fascinating. Okay, this gives us a great way to represent meaning. Now let's build on that and look at processing sequences more formally using sequence models. First up, a really core task for your final exam, part of speech tagging.
Yes, part of speech, POS, tagging. This is the process of assigning a grammatical category like noun, verb, adjective, preposition, etc. to each word in a sentence.
Why is that so important?
It's a foundational step for many deeper NLP tasks. Knowing the grammatical role of each word helps immensely in understanding the sentence's structure and meaning. It's crucial for parsing, information extraction, question answering, lots of things.
And we use standard sets of these tags. The notes mention Pentry Bank and universal dependencies.
Right. There are several tag sets. The Pentry Bank tag set is very widely used for English. It has tags like NN for singular noun, NNS for plural noun, VBP for present tense verb, non-third person singular, JJ for adjective, IN for preposition, and so on. It's quite detailed. The Universal Dependencies UD project aims for a more cross-linguistically consistent set of tags, which is really helpful when working with multiple languages.
And these tags fall into categories, open and closed class.
Yes. Tags are often grouped into open class words. These are categories like nouns, verbs, adjectives, adverbs, where new words are constantly being added to the language. And closed class words, categories like determiners, the, a, prepositions on, in, pronouns, he, they, conjunctions, and, but, which have a relatively fixed and small set of members.
Okay, so tagging program as a noun tells us how it functions, but words can be ambiguous, right? Program could also be a verb.
Exactly. That's the core challenge, word ambiguity. Many words can belong to multiple POS categories depending on the context. Think of book, noun or verb, back, noun, verb, adjective, adverb. The surrounding words are usually the key to figuring out the correct tag.
So how do models learn to do this disambiguation?
We train them on large corpora that have been manually annotated with the correct POS tag for every word in context. The Brown Corpus and the Wall Street Journal, WSJ section of the Pentry Bank, are classic examples. These provide the ground truth.
And one of the classic models for POS tagging is the Hidden Markov Model, or HM.
Yes, Hidden Markov Models, HMMs, are a natural fit for sequence labeling tasks, like POS tagging. They're probabilistic sequence models. The idea is that the sequence of POS tags is a hidden sequence of states that we can't directly observe. What we do observe is the sequence of words, which are emitted by these hidden tag states.
Okay, hidden tags, observed words.
Right. An HMM is defined by a few sets of probabilities. One, initial probabilities, the probability of starting the sentence with a particular tag. Two, transition probabilities, a, the probability of moving from one tag state to another, e.g., P, noun determiner. Three, omission probabilities. B, the probability of a specific tag state emitting a particular word, P, chip, P, cat, noun.
And it makes some assumptions.
Yes. Two key simplifying assumptions. First, the probability of transitioning to the next state depends only on the current state, the Markov assumption. Second, the probability of emitting a word depends only on the current hidden state tag.
So how do you use an HMM to tag a new sentence?
The goal is to find the most likely sequence of hidden states, tags, that generated the observed sequence of words. The standard algorithm for this is the Viterbi algorithm.
Viterbi.
It's a dynamic programming algorithm, similar in spirit to the edit distance one. It efficiently finds the highest probability path, sequence of tags, through all possible tag sequences for the given word sequence. It uses a trellis structure and back pointers to reconstruct the best path.
So it leverages those transition and emission probabilities learned from the training data?
Exactly. There are other related algorithms, too. The forward algorithm calculates the total probability of observing a sequence, summing over all possible hidden state paths. And the forward-backward, or Baum-Welch algorithm, can actually be used to learn the HMM parameters, A, B, from unlabeled data. Though for POS tagging, we usually train on labeled data.
What about words the HMM hasn't seen before during training? Unknown words.
That's a big issue for HMMs. Simple approaches involve looking at word features like capitalization, is it likely a proper noun? Suffixes, collies, often indicate specific tags, and using back-off strategies where you might assign probabilities based on less specific information if the exact word wasn't seen.
Okay. The notes also mentioned MEMS and CRFs as improvements. How do they differ from HMMs?
Right. HMMs are generative models. They model the joint probability, P, tags, words, maximum entropy Markov models, MEMS, and conditional random fields, CRFs, are discriminative models. They directly model the conditional probability, P, tags, words, which is often what we actually care about for tagging.
What's the advantage of that?
Discriminative models can incorporate a much richer set of overlapping features about the input sequence without worrying about modeling the dependencies between those features. For POS tagging, you could use features like the current word, the previous word, the next word, suffix information, capitalization, previous tags, etc.
Okay. But MEMS have a problem, label bias.
Yes. MEMS can suffer from the label bias problem, where states with fewer outgoing transitions tend to unduly influence the choices made earlier in the sequence. CRFs address this. They're also discriminative, but perform a global normalization over the entire tag sequence for a given word sequence. This avoids the label bias problem and generally leads to higher accuracy. CRFs became the standard approach for quite a while.
And then came neural networks, RNNs, LSTMs.
Absolutely. Neural networks, particularly recurrent neural networks, RNNs, have become state-of-the-art for many sequence labeling tasks, including POS tagging. RNNs have cycles, allowing them to maintain a hidden state, a sort of memory of the sequence process so far. This lets them capture dependencies between words, even those far apart.
But standard RNNs had issues with long sequences.
Yes. The vanishing gradient problem made it hard for simple RNNs to learn long-range dependencies. That led to the development of more complex architectures like long short-term memory, LSTM networks, and gated recurrent units, GRUs. LSTMs and GRUs use special gates, input-output, forget gates and LSTMs, to control the flow of information into and out of their memory cells. This allows them to selectively remember relevant information over long sequences and forget irrelevant parts.
So they're better at capturing context.
Much better. Bidirectional LSTMs, which process the sequence both forwards and backwards and combine the hidden states, are particularly effective for POS tagging because the tag of a word depends on context from both sides. Often, a CRF layer is added on top of the BILSTM output for the final tag prediction. More recently, transformers with their self-attention mechanism have also shown excellent performance on these tasks.
Okay, that's a great overview of POS tagging techniques. Now let's look at sentence structure beyond just word tags. Constituency parsing.
Yes, constituency parsing, also known as phrase structure parsing. It aims to break down a sentence into its constituent parts or phrases, showing how they nest within each other to form the overall sentence structure. Think noun phrases, NP like big cat, verb phrases, VP like sat on the mat, prepositional phrases, PP like on the mat. These phrases are thought to behave as syntactic units.
So instead of a flat sequence of tags, we're building a tree structure.
Exactly. A hierarchical tree structure, often called a parse tree. The leaves of the tree are the words of the sentence, and the internal nodes represent the constituent phrases, NP, VP, PP, S for sentence, etc. Context-free grammars, CFGs, are the standard formalism used to define the rules for building these trees.
What's in a CFG?
A CFG has four main components. One, a set of non-terminal symbols like NP, VP, S, representing the phrase types. Two, a set of terminal symbols, the actual words or POS tags. Three, a set of production rules like SDME, VP, or NP.N or NCAT, showing how non-terminals can be expanded. Four, a designated start symbol, usually S. A derivation is the process of applying these rules starting from S to generate the sequence of words. The parse tree is a visual representation of this derivation.
But sentences can be ambiguous, right? Like, I saw the man with the telescope who has the telescope.
Precisely. That's structural ambiguity. That sentence has two possible parse trees, depending on whether the PP with the telescope attaches to the noun phrase the man has it, or the verb phrase saw, I used it to see. CFGs can naturally represent this ambiguity by allowing multiple derivations for the same sentence.
So how does a computer figure out the correct or possible parse trees for a sentence given a CFG? The notes mention the CKY algorithm.
The CKY, Kakkasami-Younger algorithm, is a classic dynamic programming algorithm for constituency parsing. It's guaranteed to find all possible parses for a sentence according to a given CFG.
There's a catch. It needs the grammar in a special form.
Yes. The standard CKY algorithm requires the CFG to be converted into Chomsky normal form, CNF. In CNF, all rules must look like either ABC, a non-terminal expands to exactly two other non-terminals, or AW, a non-terminal expands to a single terminal word.
Why that restriction?
It simplifies the dynamic programming logic. Any CFG can be converted to CNF, though it might make the grammar larger and less intuitive.
So how does CKY work, roughly?
It builds a table, often called a chart or parse table. For a sentence with n words, it's an nxn triangular grid. Each cell, iju, in the table stores the set of non-terminals that can generate the span of words from index I to index j. It fills the table bottom up. First, the diagonal cells, spans of length 1, are filled based on the aw rules, which words can be which non-terminals, like nouns. Then, for longer spans, ij, it considers all possible slip points, k, between I and j. It checks that there's a rule ABC such that B is in cell IK and C is in cell K plus 1J. If so, it adds A to cell IJ.
And if the start symbol S ends up in the top cell representing the whole sentence?
Then the sentence is grammatical according to the CFG, and you can reconstruct the parse tree by tracing back how each non-terminal was derived. Modern parsers often use probabilistic CFGs, BCFGs, where rules have probabilities, and aim to find the most likely parse tree. Neural approaches that score spans or build trees compositionally are also now state-of-the-art. Evaluation uses metrics like Parseval, precision recall F1 on constituents.
Okay, so CKY systematically builds up possible phrases. Now, what about dependency parsing? How is that different?
Dependency parsing offers an alternative view of sentence structure. Instead of focusing on hierarchical phrases, constituents, it focuses on the direct grammatical relationships, or dependencies, between individual words. These relationships are represented as directed arcs, arrows, between words. The arrow goes from the head, or governor word, to the dependent word.
So, like, the verb might be the head of its subject and object.
Exactly. And an adjective might be a dependent of the noun it modifies. Each dependency arc is usually labeled with a grammatical relation type, like an subject for nominal subject, dubject for direct object, a mod for adjectival modifier. The whole structure forms a dependency tree, or graph, technically, usually with a special root node connected to the main verb.
What are the advantages of this view?
It often makes the semantic relationships, like agent, patient, more explicit. It's also argued to be better suited for languages with freer word order, where constituent structure can be less clear-cut, because dependencies are based on grammatical function, not just position.
So we get a graph showing word-to-word links instead of nested boxes.
That's a good way to think about it.
And how do computers figure out these dependency links? Transition-based parsing was mentioned.
Transition-based dependency parsing is one popular method. It works somewhat like parsing with a state machine. The parser maintains a state, typically consisting of a stack, holding partially processed words, and a buffer, holding remaining input words, plus the set of dependency arcs already built. It then applies a sequence of transitions to move from state to state. Common transitions include shift, move the first word from the buffer onto the stack, left arc, create a dependency arc from the word on top of the stack to the second word on the stack and pop the second word, right arc, create an arc from the second word to the top word and pop the top word.
And how does it know which transition to apply at each step?
That's where machine learning comes in. An oracle, typically a trained classifier, predicts the best transition to take based on features of the current state, like the words on the stack and buffer, their POS tags, existing dependency information, etc. The parser follows the oracle's predictions to build the tree. Another main approach is graph-based parsing, which tries to score all possible dependency arcs between all pairs of words in the sentence, and then find the highest scoring overall tree structure, often using algorithms like maximum spanning tree. Neural models, like biafine parsers, are very effective here.
And evaluation, how do we measure success?
Key metrics are labeled attachment score, the LAS, the percentage of words that are assigned the correct head and the correct dependency label.
Yeah.
And unlabeled attachment score, UAS, just getting the head right, ignoring the label. Label accuracy, LS, just checks the label. We also look at precision recall for specific relation types.
Okay, we've covered syntactic structure from two angles. Let's dive deeper into meaning with semantic role labeling. SRL. What's the main goal here?
Semantic role labeling, SRL, aims to identify who did what to whom, when, where, how, etc., for each predicate, typically a verb, in a sentence. It's about finding the semantic roles played by the different participants and circumstances related to the action or state described by the predicate.
So going beyond just subject to object to find the underlying roles like agent, patient, instrument.
Exactly. Grammatical roles like subject don't always map cleanly to semantic roles. For example, in the window was broken by John, the window is the subject, but semantically it's the thing that got broken, the patient or theme. Well, John is the agent. SRL tries to capture these deeper semantic roles.
Are there standard sets of these roles?
Defining a universal fixed set of thematic roles like agent, theme, goal, instrument has proven tricky. Different verbs seem to require slightly different roles, and linguists debate the exact set. So practical SRL systems often rely on resources that define roles relative to specific predicates or semantic frames. Two major ones are PropBank and FrameNet.
Tell me about those.
PropBank annotates arguments for verbs, and later nouns in NomBank, using very generic numbered roles like arg0, arg01, arg2, etc. The specific meaning of arg0 or arg1 depends on the verb. For example, for break, arg0 is the breaker, arg1 is the thing broken. It also has modifier roles like RGMLOC, location, RGMTMP, time. FrameNet takes a different approach based on frame semantics. It defines frames, which are schematic representations of situations like commerce buy, and frame elements, which are the participants and props within that frame, like buyer, seller, goods, money. SRL then involves identifying the frame and labeling the phrases that fill the frame element slots.
Okay, so how does a machine actually do SRL?
It's usually framed as a supervised machine learning task, often broken down into steps. 1. Predicate identification. Find the verbs, or sometimes nouns, that evoke semantic frames. 2. Argument identification. Find the spans of text phrases that are potential arguments of each predicate. 3. Argument classification. Assign the correct semantic role label, like arg0, patient, buyer, to each identified argument span.
And what information does it use?
Features often come from the syntactic parse tree things, like the phrase type of the argument, NPPP, its head word, the path through the parse tree from the argument to the predicate, named entity types within the argument, voice, active, passive. Deep learning models, often using BILSTMs or transformers on top of contextual embeddings and syntactic features, are now state-of-the-art. Evaluation uses precision, recall, F1 on correctly identifying and labeling the roles.
We've looked at roles. What about constraints on what can fill those roles? Selectional restrictions and preferences.
Right. Selectional restrictions are semantic constraints that predicates place on their arguments. For example, the verb eat typically requires an animate entity as its agent, argio, and something edible as its patient, or y1. You can't really say the table ate the theory. These used to be thought of as hard constraints, maybe based on semantic types from hierarchies like WordNet.
The language is flexible.
Exactly. So the idea of selectional preferences is more common now. These are soft constraints or tendencies. A verb might prefer certain types of arguments, but allow others in metaphorical or unusual contexts. We can measure the strength of these preferences statistically, perhaps using information theoretic measures like KL divergence between the distribution of arguments seen with a verb and the general distribution of nouns.
Okay, shifting to another aspect of meaning, affective meaning, sentiment analysis, connotation. This feels very relevant today.
Hugely relevant. Affective meaning covers the whole range of emotions, feelings, attitudes, opinions expressed in text. Sentiment analysis is often the most common task here, typically focused on classifying text as positive, negative, or neutral in its overall polarity or valence. Connotation refers to the emotional association or implied meaning of words beyond their literal definition. Thrifty and cheap might denote similar concepts, but have very different connotations.
And how do we measure or identify this? Lexicons.
Affective lexicons, or sentiment lexicons, are a key resource. These are lists of words that have been annotated with scores related to sentiment or emotion. Some are simple, binary, positive-negative, like the Hugh and Liu lexicon. Some are multidimensional, rating words on scales like valence, pleasantness, arousal, intensity, and dominance control, like the NRC VAD lexicon. Others assign words to discrete emotion categories, joy, anger, fear, like NRC IMLEX, or provide intensity scores. LIWC, Linguistic Inquiry and Word Count, is another tool with dictionaries for various psychological categories.
How are these lexicons built?
Various ways. Manual annotation by humans is reliable but slow. Semi-supervised methods start with a small set of seed words like good, bad, and expand the list using the SORI or distributional similarity. Supervised methods can learn word polarities from label documents.
And how are they used for analysis?
Simple approaches just count positive and negative words in a text. More sophisticated methods might weight the words by their scores from the lexicon or use lexicon features within a machine learning classifier like naive Bayes or SVMs or neural networks trained on labeled sentiment data. We can also do entity-centric analysis. What's the sentiment towards Apple? Or look at connotation frames. How do different verbs frame their arguments sentiment-wise?
Okay, moving from sentiment to facts. Information extraction, i.e., what's the goal there?
Information extraction, i.e., is about automatically identifying and structuring specific types of factual information from unstructured or semi-structured text, turning free text into database entries, essentially.
What kinds of information?
Key subtasks include named entity recognition, NER, finding mentions of predefined categories like person, organization, location, date, we'll revisit this, relation extraction, identifying semantic relationships between named entities, for example, finding pairs of entities, person, organization, linked by a works for relation. This can use patterns, like Hirsch patterns, X such as Y suggests Y is a type of X, supervised learning, or distant supervision, using existing knowledge bases like Wikidata to auto-label text. Event extraction, identifying mentions of events and their participants, who, what, when, where. For example, finding mentions of acquisition events and extracting the acquirer, acquired company, and price. Temporal extraction and normalization, finding mentions of times and dates, yesterday, next Tuesday, next 3/2024, and normalizing them to a standard format. The overall goal is often template filling, populating predefined slots in a template with information extracted from the text.
And for deeper reasoning, we need logical meaning representation.
Ideally, yes. Logical meaning representation aims to translate natural language sentences into a formal, unambiguous logical language, where we can perform logical inference and reasoning. First-order logic, FOL, is a common target representation. It allows us to represent objects, constants, properties of objects, predicates like tall John, and relations between objects, predicates like loves Mary John. Mm. We can build a knowledge base, KB, of facts and rules in FOL. Then we can use inference procedures, like backward chaining from Prolog, to deduce new facts or answer questions based on the KB. Representing nuances like events, time, and modality in FOL is an ongoing challenge.
Okay, this gives us a fantastic foundation in so many core NLP areas. Now let's pick it to the more recent, really transformative stuff, starting with masked language models like BERT. What's the big deal with these?
Masked language models, MLMs, with BERT, bidirectional encoder representations from Transformers, being the most famous initial example, really changed the game. Unlike traditional LMs that process text left to right, BERT uses the transformer architecture, specifically the encoder part, to learn bidirectional representations. This means when it calculates the representation for a word, it looks at both the words before it and the words after it in the sentence simultaneously.
Okay, so it gets the full context.
Exactly. This allows it to build much richer, deeper, more context-aware representations of words and sentences. They're pre-trained on massive amounts of text, learning general language understanding capabilities.
Yeah.
Models like Roberta and XLM Roberta are further refinements.
And the masked part is how they learn this.
Precisely. The primary pre-training task is masked language modeling, MLM itself. You take an input sentence and randomly hide, or mask, about 15% of the words. Usually 80% of the time the masked word is replaced with a special mask token, 10% of the time with a random other word, and 10% of the time left unchanged. This helps the model learn representations for unmasked words too. The model's job is then to predict the original identities of these masked words, based only on the surrounding unmasked context. It's like a fill-in-the-blanks task, forcing the model to understand context deeply to make good predictions.
That sounds like a really clever way to force bidirectional understanding. What about next sentence prediction, NSP, mentioned for BERT?
Right, the original BERT also had a second pre-training task.
Yeah.
Right. Next sentence prediction, NSP. The model was given two sentences, A and B, and had to predict if B was the actual sentence that followed A in the original text or just a random sentence. Special token CLS at the beginning and SEP between sentences were used. The idea was to help the model understand relationships between sentences, useful for tasks like question answering or natural language inference.
Did it work?
Later models like Roberta found that NSP might not be that helpful and could even hurt performance sometimes, so they dropped it and just focused on MLM with different masking strategies or larger batches.
And these models learn on huge amounts of data.
Massive amounts. Wikipedia, books corpus, common crawl web data, billions and billions of words. This pre-training is computationally very expensive, but results in powerful general-purpose language models. The output is contextual embeddings. The representation for bank will be different depending on whether the sentence is about money or rivers.
And then for a specific task, you don't train from scratch, you fine-tune.
Exactly. That's the pre-train then fine-tune paradigm. You take the general-purpose pre-train model, like BERT, and do a relatively small amount of additional training on your specific tasks labeled data. You usually add a small task-specific layer on top of the pre-trained model. For sequence classification, like sentiment, you might add a classifier on top of the CLS token's output embedding. For sequence pair classification, like NLI, determining if one sentence entails, contradicts, or is neutral to another, you feed both sentences separated by SEP and classify using the CLS token. For sequence labeling, like NER or POS tagging, you add a classifier on top of each word's output embedding to predict its tag. Handling subword tokenization, like word piece used by BERT, gets a bit tricky here for aligning tags.
This transfer learning approach seems incredibly efficient.
It is. It leverages the vast knowledge learned during pre-training, requiring much less task-specific data to achieve high performance compared to training models from scratch.
Okay, from BERT to the giants, large language models, LLMs. These are everywhere now. What defines them?
Large language models, LLMs, are essentially scaled-up versions of the transformer architecture, often decoder-only like GPT, or encoder-decoder like T5, trained on even more data with vastly more parameters, billions or even trillions. Their core capability is incredibly fluent prompt completion. You give them some text, the prompt, and they generate a coherent continuation. Their sheer scale allows them to capture incredibly complex patterns in language, leading to emergent abilities.
And interacting with them is often about prompting rather than fine-tuning.
That's become a major paradigm. Prompting involves carefully crafting the input text given to the LLM to elicit the desired behavior or output for a specific task, without necessarily retraining the model's weights. Prompt engineering is the art and science of designing effective prompts. This involves choosing the right format, question answering, fill in the blank, providing clear instructions, maybe giving a few examples.
Examples in the prompt itself.
Yes, that's in-context learning. You can often get an LLM to perform a new task just by showing it a few examples, input-output pairs, directly within the prompt. Zero-shot learning uses just instructions. One-shot uses one example. Few-shot uses several. This ability to learn from examples on the fly is remarkable.
And there are different strategies for prompting.
Lots of them. Chain of thought prompting encourages the model to output its reasoning steps before the final answer, which helps with complex reasoning tasks. Instruction fine-tuning, like with LLM or Alpaca, involves fine-tuning LLMs on a massive collection of tasks described via natural language instructions, making them much better at following instructions in a zero-shot way. Retrieval Augmented Generation, RAG, combines LLMs with external information retrieval systems to reduce hallucination and provide answers based on up-to-date or private information. Modern LLMs can even be prompted to use external tools or APIs.
But they still have limitations, right? Hallucination. Bias.
Absolutely. Hallucination, making things up confidently, is a major issue. They can inherit and amplify biases from their training data. Ensuring safety, fairness, and truthfulness is a huge ongoing challenge. Techniques like reinforcement learning from human feedback, RLHF, are used to align LLM behavior more closely with human preferences and values by training a reward model based on human judgments and then optimizing the LLM against that reward model.
A rapidly evolving field. Let's switch to another major application, machine translation, MT. What makes translating between languages so hard for machines?
Oh, MT is incredibly challenging because languages differ in so many ways, these language divergences. Word order is a big one, SVO versus SOV versus VSO languages. This affects where things like preposition postpositions go. Lexical divergences are common. One word in language A might map to multiple words in language B, depending on context, requiring word sense disambiguation. There might be lexical gaps, no direct word for a concept. How events are described can differ, verb-framed versus satellite-framed languages. Referential density varies. Pro-drop languages omit pronouns more often. And morphology. Languages vary wildly from isolating, like Chinese, few affixes, to polysynthetic, complex words with many morphemes. This affects how we even break words down, tokenization.
So, simple word-for-word replacement is doomed to fail.
Utterly. Modern MT relies heavily on neural networks, specifically the encoder-decoder architecture usually built with transformers now. The goal is, given a source sentence, generate the target sentence, P, target source.
How does that architecture work?
You feed the source sentence, usually tokenized into subwords using BPE or similar, into the encoder. The encoder processes it using self-attention layers in a transformer and produces a set of context-rich representations of the source words. The decoder then takes these encoder outputs and generates the target sentence word by word. At each step, it looks at the source context via a cross-attention mechanism focusing on relevant source words and the target words generated so far via causal self-attention to predict the next target word.
And training requires parallel data.
Yes, lots of it. Parallel corpora, or bitexts, like parliamentary proceedings, translated books, subtitles, are essential. These need to be aligned, usually at the sentence level. Data cleaning is also crucial.
How does the decoder actually choose the best translation sequence? Beam search again.
Beam search is the standard decoding algorithm. Instead of just greedily picking the single most likely next word at each step, it keeps track of the top K, the beam with most probable partial translations, hypotheses. At each step, it extends each hypothesis with possible next words, scores the extended hypotheses, and keeps only the new top K. This explores a better part of the search space. Length normalization is often applied to avoid favoring short sentences.
What about translating languages without much parallel data? Low-resource MT.
That's a big challenge. Techniques include data augmentation, like back translation. Train a target-to-source model on available data, use it to translate monolingual target data into synthetic source data, then add the synthetic parallel data to train the source-to-target model. Using multilingual models trained on many language pairs simultaneously can also help through cross-lingual transfer.
And how is MT quality measured? BLEU.
BLEU, bilingual evaluation understudy, is a classic automatic metric. It measures the overlap of n-grams, sequences of 1, 2, 3, 4 words, between the machine translation and human reference translations, with a penalty for translations that are too short. Sacre Bleu provides a standardized way to compute BLEU for better comparability. More recently, embedding-based metrics like BERT score measure semantic similarity and often correlate better with human judgment.
Okay, finally, let's wrap up by briefly touching on information retrieval, question answering, and dialogue systems, key applications mentioned in the course description that pull many of these threads together.
Right. Information retrieval, IR, is the classic search engine problem, finding relevant documents from a large collection given a user query. Traditional methods rely heavily on inverted indexes, mapping words to documents containing them, and scoring documents based on query term matches. Often using weighting schemes like TF-IDF or BM25, combined with cosine similarity between query and document vectors, sparse vectors. Evaluation uses metrics like precision, recall, MAP, MRR.
And neural methods are used now too.
Yes. Dense vector representations are increasingly used in IR to handle vocabulary mismatch, synonyms, and capture semantic relevance better. Bi-encoders efficiently encode queries and documents into dense vectors separately, allowing fast similarity search, for example, using libraries like FACE or approximate nearest neighbor search. Retrieval augmented generation, RAG, as we mentioned with LLMs, is crucial for modern question answering QA. A retriever first finds relevant passages, then a reader generator model, often an LLM, synthesizes an answer based on the retrieved context.
And dialogue systems, chatbots and assistants.
Dialogue systems aim to build conversational agents. Older systems were often frame-based or slot-filling systems for specific tasks, like booking flights, relying on identifying user intents and filling predefined slots. They involve components like natural language understanding, NLU intent classification, slot tagging, dialogue state tracking, keeping track of the conversation, dialogue policy, deciding the next action, and natural language generation, NLG. Modern chatbots often leverage large language models, sometimes fine-tuned on conversational data or using retrieval-based methods. Understanding concepts from human conversation like dialogue acts, inform, request, acknowledge, turn-taking, and grounding is important. Evaluation is complex, involving task success metrics like slot error rate for task-based systems and qualitative measures like engagingness, coherence, user satisfaction. Ethical considerations like bias, safety, and privacy are also paramount.
This has been an incredibly comprehensive journey through the core concepts of natural language processing. Wow, we've covered so much. From the absolute basics of getting text ready, all the way to complex models like transformers and LLMs and key applications like translation and dialogue, this should give anyone listening, especially for that final exam, a really solid review.
Absolutely. Hopefully it helped connect the dots. Remember to definitely revisit your own course notes and the specific details and examples covered there. Seeing how these concepts build on each other from tokenization right up to LLMs really shows the power and the complexity of getting machines to understand us.
It really does. And maybe a final thought to chew on after the exam stress is over. With NLP moving so fast, especially with these huge language models, how do you see this field changing how we interact with technology and maybe even each other in the next few years? What are the most exciting possibilities and maybe the biggest challenges we need to think about? Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.